Today is the last day of January. January 31st, 2014. The way this January has gone, I think everybody's happy to see it go. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm here with Alderman David Ahrens, and we are here on the fourth floor of the City-County building here in downtown Madison. David, for sound quality purposes, could you say your last name and spell? Say your name, spell your last name.
David Ahrens, A-H-R-E-N-S.
That looks really good. I'm just going to take a quick peek here and see what we have. I think it's going to work just fine. David, as I was saying before we turned the recorder on, why I'm interested in you is your involvement in the 2011 protests, but since I have you here, I want to get a little context to your life, and particularly your life on campus. So from what I found out about you, you've been in town for 30-plus years.
Right.
So let's ask a first question. What brought you to Madison?
I came here to go to graduate school. I was a late graduate student. Prior to coming to graduate school, I had worked for different unions for 3 or 4 years on the East Coast and in the D.C. area and San Francisco, and decided I would like and could benefit from getting a graduate degree in labor relations. And at the time, Madison had probably the, not the premier school, but the, probably the second most credited and established, well-established schools in labor relations. And it was called the Institute for Research in IRRI. IRRI, the Institute for...
Was poverty in it? Was it poverty?
No, poverty was, wasn't in it. So anyway, it was a labor relations school, and it had been around since John Commons and so on. And so I got lucky to get a scholarship there, and so decided this was the place to be. Part of the scholarship, though, was at the same time as my that I went to school, I began working for the AFSCME, that's the County and Municipal Employees Council here. And really after a year or so, my attention to school really started to wane as my sort of integration with the goings on at the union level increased. So I really didn't, you know, I was one of those people who took all my classes either on a Monday or Wednesday or a Tuesday or Thursday to limit the amount of time that I had to spend on campus. But I got a degree after all was said and done. And then immediately began working for AFSCME, sort of the day after graduation. I became a labor relations rep.
If you don't mind, I wouldn't mind backing up a little bit. You said you'd worked in unions prior to coming to graduate school. So when did you begin wanting to be involved in unions?
I started working for a union in 1976 in Baltimore. Actually, at the time, I was working in the Baltimore Personnel Department and doing personnel work, not labor relations, but personnel, so there's a substantive difference. And it was one of those things that were kind of clicks in your mind and you sort of happens and you ask a lot of fundamental questions. What happened there was a layoff within the personnel department, and in those days, this is 1976, the five oldest people in the department were fired. And including, you know, people who I had professional and personal relationships with. And I was a young guy, I was 20-something years old, and I was just shocked and outraged that they fired the five oldest people. And there was no age discrimination law in those days. And I said, well, what should I do about it? Well, I'll call a union. I was pretty naive. And so I remember I called the auto workers union. It was the only union that I could think of at the time. And then I said, boy, we need a union here, and the auto workers ought to get over here quickly, and because people all over this, you know, city employment are upset. And they handed my number off over to someone from the County and Municipal Employees Union in Maryland at the time, and they handed my number off to someone else in the union, and I met with these people from the National Union, and I must have seemed like a really gung-ho kind of guy, and they said, well, why don't you come over and work with us? And I mean, it just completely caught me, like, out of the blue. I wasn't thinking about that. We'll pay you the same thing. Tell me what these other people pay. Baltimore pays you. We'll do you the same. And we'll give you some training and spread the gospel. You know, you got the message. And so I did. And though I did a little work in Baltimore, I soon became an international rep, which means I traveled through a 3 or 4 state area in around the D.C. sort of huge metro area, Virginia, West Virginia, Delaware, Maryland, and did work on organizing campaigns and strikes. Those were the days before most places had collective bargaining, and people struck to get collective bargaining rights, and or even absent of collective bargaining, struck for pay anyway, even though there was no union, and the union would be involved with that. So many of those places had no, as we say, no law or very minimal rights to situations where there is a full labor relations statute and process in play, like we used to have here. So it was quite a whirlwind experience for a young man. My first day on the job, I remember, I went with the guy who was my boss, and we went to a negotiation, and the negotiation was 18 hours long. And it was just an amazing process. It was the last day of what had been months of negotiations, and the last session was from like 10 in the morning to 4 o'clock in the morning. And the guy who I was working with was a old guy, probably older than I am now. And I remember coming into our caucus room, and he at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he was doing push-ups to to stay awake and alert. So that was quite a process. So anyway, stayed with them for about 2 years or so, and for personal reasons, you know, girlfriend, I moved out to California and got a job working as a banquet waiter, but soon became very involved in the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union in San Francisco, which at the time was going through a revolutionary, truly a revolutionary change. It had been under the thumb of the same leadership for over 30 years. Of course, San Francisco had changed in the past 30 years. And the union was very mob-oriented, shall we say. Both the San Francisco and the Las Vegas locals. Las Vegas was Local 1, San Francisco was Local 2. So, I mean, these were long-standing unions of very big unions, very big locals. And there had been there was a grassroots campaign to change over what was a very sclerotic leadership that had been in place for, as I said, for 30 years. And the campaign was just, I was very lucky in that I came in when it was, I mean, I didn't have to, I was not involved with building it. I came in when it was well established. And it was remarkable. I mean, we printed a newspaper in four languages every month. I mean, and it was a newspaper in English, Spanish, Tagalog, and Chinese. And so the process, I mean, we organized in every hotel. It was mostly hotels, big hotels and long-established restaurants. Was a long process. I mean, and finally we had, the election had to be supervised by the Department of Labor because of all the problems with the hotel and restaurant workers nationally at the time. So lawyers went to court and demanded federal oversight of the election. And the elections took place were 3 days, 24 hours a day, because everybody worked shifts all through the day and night. And so I was the monitor. I was the chief monitor for our side on the election. And unfortunately, they forced us to have only one location for the whole city. So here you had, it was 17,000 members of the local. One location in the city. And 10,000 people cast ballots. So people, we really got people to understand, people understood really by virtue of their workplace, this is really important. You better vote. It's more important than a presidential election or anything else. You better vote. Also, of course, many of these people couldn't vote in a presidential election. But anyway, people came after their shift at 11 to 7 as, you know, night cooks or cleaners and hotels, and came down to, I forget what street it was, and voted. I mean, we had, on the last day, we had dragon dances in the streets, you know, for the Chinese folks, and Tagalog drum bands, Filipino drum bands, and it was fantastic. And we won. But the downside of the story was that we were soon put in what's called trusteeship by the National Union. And then that led to a whole series of federal court cases and redo elections. The people in Las Vegas also won, and they were all killed. And that, for our guy who was our president, he just couldn't handle it. And when they were killed, he just couldn't handle it and was hospitalized. I mean, he just really mentally became unhinged. And that gave part of the cause for the National Union to say that the leadership was unable to implement contracts and so on. Mm-hmm. It was really a... So after, you know, a month out, we were then in the trusteeship, and then it just became, when you get too involved in all this litigation stuff and so on, it just strips all the power from members. You say, well, we're in court. Why aren't we the leaders anymore? Why is these, you know, mob guys from Washington now at our meeting again? Well, blah, blah, blah. And it's just all kind of mystifying to people who are not used to those kinds of processes. And they have really no say. I mean, basically, so there's nothing we can do. Well, we can protest that, and we're sending our lawyers. But in terms of what do we do at the workplace, what's different, you know, let's try to be more aggressive, but still the leadership will stop it. Mm-hmm.
So was it around this time that you started looking for...
Right.
For something different.
Something different, yeah. And so then I decided to... I was pretty burnt out, and people were, as you can imagine, somewhat discouraged at that. I mean, I just saw this going on and on, and it did. It just went on in court battles and redo elections and so on for years. So then I came here. So I got a scholarship here through AFSCME and went to school and
so you said
union representation work.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So you said that in your mind this was the second best school for labor relations.
Yeah, Cornell is sort of the premier. It's a big school. It's in fact has status as a school where we had. This was an institute. It was Industrial Relations Research Institute.
Yeah,
that's what it was called. And so it's, you know, the scope of it was smaller.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did you find out about it?
Oh, it's a well-known
okay.
school. I mean, I think if you're at the time in 1980 or 79 or something, the Wisconsin, I mean, it's the great Wisconsin School of Economics, and it's closely related to the econ department. Most of the real faculty for the labor relations, they were housed in the econ department.
Okay. So how was your, pretty broad question, but your adjustment to Madison? I assume this was your first time. Was this your first time in Madison when you came
first
here?
Time in the Midwest, yeah. Right. It was quite an adjustment. I mean, I'd come from San Francisco, and San Francisco, and I go back often because my family lived there. It was a different city then, of course, and it was much more diverse city. I mean, there actually were lots of Chinese and Tagalog, Filipino, and so on, Latinos living in the city and workplaces, and that's really the people who I worked with. And and then I came here, and this city at the time was probably like 95% white. And before San Francisco, I lived in Baltimore and worked there, which was a majority black city. Mm-hmm. And doing union work, everybody I worked with was black because it was for unskilled trades, you know, unskilled workers. I mean, I was, you know, organizing garbage collectors, and that was sort of the main stock of people who I worked with, garbage collectors, sewer workers, water workers, street department people, and so coming to Madison, which was at the time, just, I remember driving into town, and I could not believe all the white people. I mean, I should have figured that this was going to be all white people. And, you know, I sort of had this map, and I drove up to the university, and it was just all white people. And so that was strange. But school was really, I think you'll find that it's a problem for... it can be a problem for people who have been in the field to then go study the academic version of what their experience is. Now, the academic version may be, in a generalizable sense, true, but there's definitely going to be dissonance between one's specific experiences and that academic version of it. Mm-hmm. So I took a class in collective bargaining and negotiations, and there just seemed to be a quite a dissonance and big difference between what the professors were teaching and what my 4 or 5 years of experience was. Also, I only had one professor who ever ever had any actual experience in collective bargaining, and that had been just for two or three years, decades before. That was a disadvantage. I really believe it was a disadvantage.
So your background made you feel like it was a disadvantage?
I felt like at the time I felt like I know all this stuff. And I even knew some of the academic aspects of it. Read a little of the literature while I was actually working in it. But looking back at it, I felt like, if I had come in like the other graduate students, most of whom were just coming directly from undergraduate school, they just have sort of this open mind about it. And, the teacher tells, this is how things are, these are the facts, and so on. Mm-hmm. This is how collective bargaining works. So you can read it on page 200 to 244. And people take it at its word, and I would be, in the class raising my hand and saying, well, but what about, just being a kind of disagreeable person that I am, that always worked, sometimes worked against me. Felt that things would have went smoother and easier if I had just gone into collective bargaining and labor relations the same way that I went into my statistics course. I really had no point of view going into my stats course.
So did you seek out union work before you started school or here?
Yeah.
So did you already have something set up?
I knew I'd be working with an AFSCME group of some kind, and so I started working for the county municipal employees, and more or less stayed with them for about 7 years. Yeah.
So you had the, and you've already talked about this, but I'll comment and see what, it sounds like you had the sort of the double disadvantage of being a non-traditional student in terms of age.
Yeah, so I was older than cohort, folks. Yeah.
Cohort-wise, you're off age, and then you had practical experience where the rest of them, at least it sounds like for the most part, the rest of the students and even most of the faculty didn't have sort of practical labor relations.
Right, I was... Yeah, I was sort of surprised, really, that I was the only person. There was one other guy who was my age, maybe a little older, who had been a personnel officer for X number of years and was going back to school. But other than that, it was almost, I think, 100% of the people were just coming out of undergraduate school. I thought it would be like people going back to school to get a master's degree in education, where there'd be a lot of people who had been in the classroom, or RNs going and getting a master's degree in nursing or something. Because it's UW, even though most of the people, this was, as they say, their terminal degree, they still wanted people to encourage people to go and become academics and get a PhD. So there was always a certain percentage of people sort of after the first year that would either, chose to or encouraged to continue into a doctoral program, which I had no interest in doing.
Let's sort of back up. What part of town did you, when you got here, what part of town did you live
in? I lived on the east side, primarily. I lived with, someone who is in the doctoral department, in the economics department, who's getting his PhD in economics. So there were the economics department in those days, and I'm sure it's not at all anymore. There was a famous economist here, John Commons, who's turn of the century person, who did little things like unemployment compensation, workers' compensation, those social revolutions. He was really the initiator, sort of the architect of many of those programs, developed an academic basis for it, but was obviously a doer and worked on implementing those at the state level. And Wisconsin was the first state to implement both of those programs. And he was the chair of the economics department. Well, as a sort of from the Commons tradition, one part of the Commons tradition, I should say, is what's called institutional economics. And that is, I'm going to define that. It's almost defined as what it's not now. That is, it's these are not quantoids. You know, there's of course, they have to use quantitative analysis in terms of doing, studying an issue like wage levels and employment levels as a result of unemployment compensation. But they're not statisticians necessarily, and or econometricians. And really, that's sort of the avenue that where the department became. But my roommate friend for those years was in the PhD program, and of course he had a quantitative background, and but he was involved in labor economics, which was a good part of the econ program in those days, as you get a PhD in labor econ. And now he's the head of the Economic Policy Institute, and has been really functionally, in terms of economic policy, the leading labor economist in the country, other than maybe someone at the Department of Labor. But they graduated many of the people who, at the time, worked as labor economists for various unions or the remaining universities that wanted a labor economist, understanding really how labor markets operate.
So was this, to get back to it then, was this disadvantage you had, was that part of the reason why, or one of the reasons why school became not necessarily less of a priority, but you sort of focused your time in school for certain periods and then spent the rest of the time?
School was sort of the unreal world, and just sort of I felt by the second year I was just getting my ticket punched and wanted to get back to things that really happened to people. My roommate in the PhD program, and he also had, in between undergraduate and graduate school, he had worked for UAW and someplace else. So he had institutional experience in understanding how labor relations functions.
So then you came here in the early 80s.
79 was, how do you remember these things? I remember when Reagan won, and I watched the results with other staff from the union. And so I think I was in my second year then. I don't think I would have been there right when I started. So I probably started in 79.
So this is a general statement, but so except for the time you were on campus earning your master's degree, did you have much involvement with either campus activism or labor issues on campus?
Well, the TAA strike occurred in 81. And it's funny, because I had a fellowship, I was given an office there. And I really didn't use the office. I mean, I had an office at the union, so I didn't really. I mean, for people who are RAs and working for professors and so on, office made sense, but I really didn't need one very. So I used it to study as my place to study and do work. And the guy who's in the office right next to me was the president of the TAA, David Hecker, and he had the loudest voice. He must have had like hard of hearing parents or something. But if he was on the phone, it would be too like it would be so loud, and these were like these cement block walls at the social science building. It was so loud. So I used to hear sort of like the day-to-day events of what was happening and leading up to the TAA strike. So the TAA strike was a long strike, and it was, I mean, the TAA had already had recognition. I mean, so that happened many years before. Mm-hmm. But it was ultimately unsuccessful in what they had to do, which was to shut down classes. So classes continued, especially at the undergraduate level. And they went back to work after a long period it out. But, you know, it wasn't definitional in terms of that it either caused the decline or tremendous growth in it. I mean, one of the things that it did do, and this was a problem, sort of one of these weird secondary effects, they picketed the bus, like the bus barn, or the area where buses came onto campus, like at the hospital, and the Teamsters refused to cross the line, and so there was no bus service on campus. Well, those guys lost their pay. So when the Teamsters, a half a year later, so these guys were out of work for 35 days or whatever it was. Well, shortly thereafter, the city and the Teamsters union got into this contract dispute. And a good friend of mine was an officer, president or vice president of the bus drivers union, and and I remember having this conversation with him where he was saying that it was difficult to strike the city because so many workers, so many members had lost their pay during the TA strike that they were averse to now going out again for an interminable period of time. So it's just sort of one of these secondary effects of things that actually it turned out really to their benefit. It was a good, and what happened was, and this is really tangential, Teamsters used to have, up to that point, they had what's called a COLA agreement, which is a cost of living adjustment. So whatever the rate of inflation was, they got that plus a half a percent. And they had that for years. And they had that through a period of, through the late 70s, during Carter's last years, which was a period of terrific inflation. And of course, they loved their COLA. And the city wanted to buy it back from them. And they didn't want to give it up, and they were ready to strike for it. Well, but they settled instead for, and actually I negotiated the same agreement in some other place at the same time. They was I sold a cola in Racine. So I sold it for three tens, 10% each year for 3 years. Well, as it turns out, inflation fell. The whole country went into a recession a year after Reagan came into office, and inflation rate was like 2 or 3%. These guys made out like bandits. If they had stuck with their cola, they'd be making 20% less money than they are now. So, but I remember I had so many meetings with these guys to encouraging them to give up their cola, because 3 10% pay hikes would bring home the bacon, and it really did. Anyway, so all these weird chain of events, the TAA strike, caused these guys to secondary picket, shut down, not strike, and they came out way ahead of the city on that as well.
But overall, at least in your opinion, the TAA strike didn't necessarily benefit the TAA, though.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No. I mean, I remember there were a number, I had differences with a number of different strategic, tactical differences with what they were, how they conducted the strike. And,
so then, so besides the TAA strike, do you recall other, and also, again, beside the fact that you were going to school there, any other?
That really wasn't involved with campus very much. I was not part of sort of the graduate student social thing. It's a fairly small group of industrial relations students, say 40 or 50. And, I mean, they had a, you know, they're pretty group-oriented, of course, and that really wasn't my social group. Because of my work with AFSCME, I was already involved with sort of other labor activists and so on campus, and not on campus, in the city, and just also older people.
More of your age.
More of my age, or yeah, people who had settled, had families, and so on. I mean, my best friend, who was a student, was an Italian graduate student, and he had come on a Fulbright here to get his PhD, and he had been a substantial position. Mm-hmm. In a union in Italy for 6 years before coming here. And so, I mean, I spent time with him and his wife.
So maybe we should, I guess, sort of fast forward then.
Yeah.
Is 1996 then the next sort of time that you become involved in campus with the Cancer Center?
Right.
So if you would mind starting by giving an overview of how that came
about. I had, transitioned through, fast forward through some careers. So stayed with the union, went to a different union, then worked in the legislature for, on and off, for about 6 years or so. And my last 2 years at the union, I started the research office for the union, was a research director for the state union. And the union, a good part of its membership were healthcare workers, the non-professional healthcare workers who worked in county and nonprofit nursing homes and hospitals. So as a result of that, I became very knowledgeable and involved with how healthcare is funded and healthcare financing. And for personal reasons, I had married a labor arbitrator, and it really became it was not feasible for me to be as a union advocate with my wife as an arbitrator who was hearing cases with my union. And because the main part of my job was doing these arbitrations. So even if I of course would never do it with her, but her colleagues and so on, was an uncomfortable situation. So I had an opportunity, she didn't want to leave her position, and I had an opportunity to leave mine. So I went to work in the legislature for the Health Committee, and who works a lot with how healthcare is financed. Did that, and but also became involved with public health issues, and particularly smoking and drinking, because the chair of the committee was a former public health nurse. And so I was her staff person for the committee. So I became involved with that. So this was just the first beginnings of smoking as a national health issue. And really, they really had very novice kind of, they being the, you know, Cancer Society, the anti-smoking groups, very novice lobbyists. And so they had convinced, through a series of things, they convinced the UW Cancer Center to get a grant that would hire some people to start a state anti-tobacco coalition and local tobacco group, anti-tobacco groups, to change local and state policies. So, given my background in public health and organizing, the Cancer Center hired me to start the organization. And I did. And worked, stayed with it for, I stayed in that organization as the director for 3 or 4 years, and then I and a faculty in the medical school wrote a grant to finance a much bigger, well-funded group, and we were funded. And then the question whether I wanted to stay with that I could spin off and do Smoke-Free Wisconsin, which is what the organization was, or I could stay at the Cancer Center and be a researcher there in public policy. And I chose the latter.
So let's maybe delve into this for a couple of questions, and then we're probably at the wrap-up point. So first off, when you were hired to be the person in charge, where did that position you on campus?
Well, we were first off campus for two or three years. We were off campus. We were way out on Monroe Street. So, I mean, it was part of UW, but we were not on campus. And then we I got a grant for a lot of money and needed a lot of space. And so we moved to the Wharf building.
So after the bigger grant?
Yeah, we moved to the Wharf.
Then you moved to Wharf.
Mm-hmm.
So for those first couple of years when you were on Monroe Street, it sounds like you weren't on campus, but you were sort of campus?
Yeah, right. I was, you know, I shared an office with another cancer center group that was not, that was a public service group. It was, it was called the Cancer Information Service. So, I mean, we had very tangential kind of relationships with the campus. Mm-hmm. And part of that was intentional. The Cancer Center, it was not, being anti-smoking then was not great PR for the Cancer Center. it was very, this was in the, you know, it's called the Carbone Cancer Center. Well, this is in the day when Carbone was alive and I knew him. And it was gutsy on his part to allow this to happen, to take on the grant, and to have an organization that said, we're part of the Cancer Center. And get into disputes with powerful interests. And so we got into disputes with retail stores, because they were selling cigarettes to kids, to restaurants, because we didn't want to be smoking in restaurants, and so on. And he was willing to take the heat on that. I mean, they have to be involved with community fundraising. It's not all NCI, ACS money, and they have to, they're dependent on goodwill of the community. And just being open, not for the Cancer Center to be perceived as a hostile entity in any way. So he was unbelievable. I mean, he was unbelievable in terms of willing to take that on, because if you actually look through the places that were funded and where their organizational home was, very few were cancer centers. Even though it would be sort of an obvious place for them to be, there may have been two or three in the country where a cancer center was willing to take this on, because it was so unpopular.
So what, I guess I'll ask it this way, although I don't know if, so the first grant, the smaller of the two grants, what would you consider to be the successes that came from that?
We began the work of establishing local, you know, viable county-based anti-tobacco groups of people who were willing to initiate or challenge public policies. Initially, the first thing was preventing youth access to tobacco. And it seems odd, but I mean, 20 years ago, that was controversial. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was thinking this the other day, how I remember being at some meeting and it happened in the legislature. We'd have people come to the legislature and say, we should be able to sell cigarettes to kids, because if I don't, I'll take a loss. This will hurt my business. So, and legislatures be, yeah, right, I guess I see your point of view. Yeah, I guess we shouldn't do anything about that. Mm-hmm. They're a good part of my customers. Mm-hmm. So we started with real, what would seem to be easy things like that, but that's how we started, and then began issues concerning secondhand smoke. And you know, the process of educating people about that took, well, it took about a decade.
So, was it because the first grant was running out that you looked for?
No, we just got, I got a much bigger grant to do a whole variety of research projects.
And who was the faculty that you worked with?
Pat Remington. He's the associate chancellor of the medical school now.
So, and it was that grant that moved you on
the
campus into
right,
the Wharf building.
Right, right.
So how did additional, I guess, were these two grants?
They were separate organizations.
Okay.
Yeah. My second grant was Robert Wood Johnson, and it allowed us to do a lot of, you know, interesting stuff, and then got some more money from the state. You know, that sort of then brought more money from the state, and we were, and I directed this what we call the surveillance and evaluation project. And surveillance, this is an epidemiological term, which sounds kind of scary in these NSA days. But I mean, surveillance simply meant doing, you know, coding people's behaviors on smoking and smoking policy, exposure to secondhand smoke, and so on. So we would do both surveys and also real air testing, biomedical testing of people who were smokers or subject to secondhand smoke. And at the time, there were a number of different projects being conducted by these counties and state groups and so on, and we would do the evaluations of those operations. So, say, in the early 2000s or so, the state had dedicated quite a bit of money to running TV ads about smoking. I don't know what state were you living in the early 2000s?
Idaho.
So you probably didn't have it there. Mm-hmm. but we were running a lot of millions of dollars worth of TV commercials about different aspects of smoking. And our unit did the evaluations of those commercials with youth and adults, smokers and non-smokers. There were just many different kinds of programs that people, most of these were, you know, pilots and experimental programs. Gee, if you do these things and have these kinds of activities for sixth graders, what happens when they're eighth graders? What happens in, if you have a smoke-free place, what happens to the number of smokers who work there? Do they give up smoking? What happens in their homes? Do they give up smoking in their homes? And, you know, those odd things happen where, because people cannot smoke in their workplace, they also give up smoking in their homes. And then, of course, after a while, you give up smoking because you're not smoking. I mean, it's just so much you could smoke in your car. And then your spouse says, stop smoking in the car. So I mean, it really pushed the area so that, you know, about, I think the last statistic that I read was like 25% of smokers or something do not smoke in their homes. So we had what was called the surveillance arm of the project, which is running a lot of mass surveys and testing, and the other part was program evaluation. The state and the federal government was spending, you know, between $15 and $20 million a year on different kinds of smoke, anti-smoking education and cessation projects. And we did the evaluations about what worked.
So I guess it sounds like to me that your activism becomes focused, at least at this part of your life, in sort of healthcare / public health. Is that a,
is that
an assumption, safe assumption?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is there any other, in the, I guess this takes us 90s, almost probably into the early 2000s.
Sure.
Any other activism or labor activities you're doing at that point?
No, I wasn't involved with labor work anymore. I was involved politically on campaigns. But I wasn't... I wasn't central to any campaign activity, shall we say. I mean, I've been, and certainly as older, but I mean, in 1986, I was on leave from work for periods of time working on a U.S. Senate campaign, and then in 88 on a state campaign. So I wasn't at that level of activity by far. I was what we'd call a reliable, you know, campaign helper. knew politicians because, you know, politicians want to know people who are reliable campaign helpers. But beyond that, wasn't that critically engaged. I was very absorbed by, there were a period of probably 4 or 5 years where I was very absorbed by this tobacco thing. At the time, probably from 98 to 2002 or 2003, there was really a fervent, almost religious kind of sense of mission that people had. That this, you know, evil tobacco industry that's killed blah, 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 and done all these, as you know, it's now known, horrible things, lies and deceit and so on, that we were going to, you know, slay the dragon. And perhaps if not slay it, then really shrink it in a miserable way. And we had money and resources to be able to do it, growing public support to do it, growing public understanding about what was happening. And so it was really quite, as I say, really absorbing. I mean, and the people that I worked with, being at the university, worked with, we had lots of graduate students and research assistants and graduate assistants and everything, and people came and were just like, I am so happy. I mean, they were, I mean, to have something that was like, wow, we're really changing society. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you could watch it. I mean, we'd look at the map and, oh, okay, let's put that dot on Oshkosh now. It has smoke-free restaurants. You know, let's put the dot here, you know. And so for people to be engaged at that level, and there was a lot of TV, you know, there was a lot of media attention to things, to that at the time, and but beyond that, I mean, people really had a great sense of mission on this. And I mean, it worked with a lot of kids, working with kids wasn't, you know, really my cup of tea. But for the people who were, I mean, I could see it from afar why you'd want to do it, because I'd go to youth events and high school events of kids against tobacco, whatever they were, people, you know, especially some of the, you know, younger people, graduate assistants and so on, were very turned on and lit up by that. And that really becomes contagious. I mean, it really becomes sort of a groupthink.
I want to, we've gone a little over an hour. I always try to give you the last word. We sort of did a whirlwind from 1976 Baltimore, and, you know, 2003 Madison. Is there anything on your mind specifically about those, you know, those decades that you feel you want to get on the record in case we don't get to it on the follow-up interview?
Not really. I'm trying to think about sort of the aspect of the, you know, sort of my relationship to the university. I mean, I had a, I mean, at the time, and this sort of became instructive at a later time when I became an employee advocate, I could look back and say, well, many people are of the mind that I was 5 or 6 years before, which was there a tremendous sense of mission. Funding is lush and solid for the foreseeable future. And, you know, sort of all as well. You know, I'm paid adequately. I mean, it was a, and then, you know, but then things, of course, changed, you know, over the next decade or so. So, you know, in terms of a lot of times people, when I was more involved in the union activity, people would be frustrated. And the other piece of that was, the third part of it is, and this was probably the most important part, was how cloistered I was. And this will come up more later, which is my sense of where I work was limited to the third and fourth and sixth floor of the Wharf building. That was the university. That's where my people were, and that was it. And the fact that there was this big cancer center over at the Clinical Science Center, and those people at Bascom Hill, that to me was just stuff on a page. You know, there really was no kind of sense of that I was somehow really part of that other than my pay status or whatever. And that's how I think most who were not academic staff who were not administrative, but academic staff who were research people, which was most of the academic staff, they're focused on, you know, this protein. And not that other protein. They're focused on this protein, and that's how I was. You know, I mean, there was another group, Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, which took up the quarters that I left on Monroe Street, and so they moved in where I left, and of course I worked with them. But those are the clinical types. You know, those people tested medicines to help people stop smoking. And I worked with them, did some joint research projects with them. But, I mean, they were sort of in my circle, but not really of it. And I'm sure they felt the same way. was they tested drugs, and I did this public policy stuff and millions of surveys and all this crazy stuff. So people have this very kind of very, very parochial view in academia, because really it's who you work with, where your money comes from. And on the research end, very, very little comes from the university. So it's very difficult to get to give people sort of some kind of broader collective view of this, that really your situation, your employment situation as a researcher in, you know, protein enlargement may be similar and so on. It's very hard. I mean, you really need a longer, broader view to be able to, and really some kind of crisis, you know, to be able to do it. And that's sort of what the question was in 2011, as to whether that crisis would precipitate both the view and then action that would flow from that. And we'll resume.
Right. We will pick up probably a few years before 2011, yeah. Okay. But thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.